sorry. I forgot to turn off the alarm.
I thought you weren't going in.
Well, I have to.
Call in sick.
No, I really do.
I really mean you ought to call in sick. You think I can let you work?
There's something I gotta get.
At the plant? Are you wearing my shirt?
Huh?
My shirt.
You don't have to get up now.
Sweetheart, don't go trying to get anything out of the plant.
Hey, if I get hung up at the union meeting, will you pick up Paul Stone and the guy from the New York Times at the airport?
Fuck no.
Come on, darling. I don't know how late this meeting's gonna go tonight.
I don't want you doing that.
Well, I'm doing it.
You don't owe the union anything.
Let's not fight.
You don't owe the New York Times anything.
Let's not have a fight now. Okay?
Okay. You can always have a fight later.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies.
The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen! And not a one of you is prepared for it!
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway.
Through many days.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Raspy Brother Jay.
This is Normal Drew.
And tonight, we're going to talk about the 1983 hit film Silkwood. Directed by Mike Nichols and written by Nora Ephron and Alice Arlen. And before we get into the movie, while making notes for it, this may be the movie that unites all of the movies on our calendar. Like, there are connections to 21 episodes with this one movie.
Wow.
It's incredible.
It's like the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
That's a lot of movies. Considering we haven't even done like Miami Blues.
I'll go through the list here, but to begin with, so Brother Jay, introduce us to Silkwood.
I don't even remember when I saw this, because I don't remember. I would have been 10 or 11 years old when this movie was released, so I can't imagine I saw it. There was no way I would have seen it in a movie theater, so it must have been a TV movie. And I remember watching it as a kid and it scaring the shit out of me because I didn't understand radiation and didn't understand what was going on. And it seemed very sinister. The whole premise and implication of what was happening in the movie was so sinister that that scared me too from a big corporation bad perspective. So often when it would come on TV growing up and as an adult, I would catch pieces of it, but couldn't make myself sit through it because I just knew what was coming. So a couple years ago, I put it on the calendar, I think, or at least a year ago, because I really wanted to go back and revisit it and see how the movie held up. And it held up pretty good, I think. But it also gave me this overwhelming sense of dread because I just knew what was coming the whole movie. So the shit still scared me and it still got me and it still made me emotional and it's I think that is kind of a testament to how great this film is, because it really stood up. And there's some, I mean, there's some obviously dated parts, but I think on a whole, it's fantastic. And for God's sakes, Kurt Russell's like 5 years old.
This movie has so many people in it.
It does.
So Drew, what's your reaction? When did you first see this movie?
I first saw this movie in college, I think.
Tell me it was for one of your nuclear engineering classes.
No. This is for our labor relations class.
Okay, so it was a labor relations class?
No, I was just kidding.
Okay.
It was his NLRB class.
No, okay, well, so for people who are not in the know, I think we've alluded to this at some point, but youngest brother Drew has a degree in nuclear engineering.
It's true.
So do parts of this movie somehow call to you as a student?
Yes. There are several scenes in this movie that made me extremely uncomfortable.
Extremely uncomfortable for realism, or extremely uncomfortable because they were just wrong?
I guess of those two choices, it would be realism. I mean, things, I guess, poor workplace practices, like eating in hot zones.
Yeah.
Or chewing gum, or like,
But yeah. Probably not unrealistic for the time and the locale.
Probably not. I mean, it's not really talked about too much in the movie, but they glossed over it. But this Kerr-McGee plant seemed to have very little actual like rad worker training.
Yeah, it seemed to me that their rules were rather relaxed.
No, they had strict rules, but nobody understood why.
Well, and they weren't enforced.
Yeah.
Well, these were factory workers. They weren't scientists. Or, I'm sorry, engineers. I don't want to bring that up. That's a whole other podcast, people. So you saw it when you were in college. What was your reaction at the time? Do you remember?
I liked it. I didn't know the story about Karen Silkwood, so I had no idea what I was getting into. And it's a really good movie. I had fond memories of it. So watching it again for this discussion, it was even better than I expected. I had so many people in it, and they were all good.
Damn, so this is the second week in a row we're all three going to agree on a movie.
Yeah, as it turns out, the first time I saw this movie was last week. And
really, you'd never seen it before?
Well, it to me, just on an overview of it, I can imagine picking up the video case at the video rental store and thinking, huh, it's a Meryl Streep movie with Cher in it, where we know that at the end, the main character's going to die. And no, I'm good. I'm going to move on to the horror section and watch Sorority Party Massacre 3 or something.
Yeah, this is one of the movies we had lying around the house that I never watched.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, this was probably on a tape with something sort of similar that I watched neither of. Like, if this had been on the same tape as Folks, I would have seen this movie. Yeah, this is a good movie. It wasn't what I was expecting. And when I read some reviews of the movie, reviews at the time, there was some criticism about the style of this movie in regard to the subject matter of this movie. But I kind of love this movie because it tells what is ultimately a tragic story, but in kind of a slice of life kind of... I mean, this is like an Oscar bait sort of movie now. But I don't know. I want to say they don't really make movies like this anymore, but maybe it's just because I don't seek out movies like this.
I think they kind of make movies like this, but they don't make them 2 hours and 10 minutes long. I mean, this was a long movie.
I think this is a weird movie because it has a protagonist who's not She's not super likable. She's not even really super competent. But she's not an anti-hero. She's a straight-up protagonist. And there's no real boogeyman. I mean, you think the corporation's doing some sketchy stuff, but that's never really brought to light. So there's a lot of like supposition and innuendo, but no real concrete bad guy.
Yeah, there's never a Pelican Brief moment where there's a paper that shows that it's coming from the top, or there's no Aaron Brockovich moment where it shows that it's coming from the top. It's implied that the company is possibly putting pressure, but not directing that pressure in any specific path to get the goal. Just they're telling the managers, this is what needs to happen, and we don't care what you do.
Yeah, my memory from watching it the first time, I had thought that Silkwood was set up, that Karen Silkwood was set up by Kerr McGee at some point and had to go to like through the decon procedures as like intimidation and punishment. I did not read that the same way this time.
Well, perhaps let's just get into the plot. So this is based on a true story, and sort of, okay, part of the reason I'm kind of beating around the bush a little bit.
Let me interrupt for just one moment, because turnabout's fair play. If anybody's listening hasn't seen this movie, go watch it, please. Go watch it now. Go watch it and then come back, because this is a movie that you deserve to watch. And even though you may have heard spoilers so far, it won't affect your watching of the movie. It is a great movie. It really needs to be something that you appreciate. So before we trot all over it, please, please go watch it.
Well, so, I'm gonna argue maybe not the opposite, because I really do think people need to watch it. I was happy that I watched it. But this could have been the Pelican Brief for Aaron Brockovich. But this isn't what this movie is about. This is like a character piece that happens to have this very serious story. But I don't think the story is the charming part of the movie. I think it's the characters that are, you know, because the acting is so well done, and the movie doesn't take itself so seriously. Like, one of the things about this movie is that, so this movie takes place in like, what, 1970, 1971 or something, in a nuclear fuel fabrication site, a Kerr McGee facility near Crescent, Oklahoma.
The Cimarron fabrication plant.
Yes. And they are making what? Plutonium for weapons?
Plutonium pellets for nuclear reactor fuel rods.
Yeah, they're making fuel rods. They're not making weapons. They mention specifically a breeder reactor.
In Washington State, right?
Mm-hmm. An experimental breeder reactor.
But again, these are just factory workers. You see them pull up to the factory in the, 1971 or whatever, like, probably not that, like Honda Civic.
Yeah, Honda CVCC.
Yeah, it looks like it looks a little bit like a gremlin. And it's Oklahoma. You know, the defining characteristics are these are a little bit of white trash folks, factory workers. And Meryl Streep as Karen Silkwood is great because, yeah, she's not super likable. She's sassy and everything, but yeah, she's not super likable. And they're dealing with, they work at a facility that has radioactive material. So there's the whole thing about contamination. And she mentions a couple times that, you know, they're worried about health concerns. But as her boyfriend, Kurt Russell, says at one point very directly,
Thelma says she's going to get cancer.
If anybody's going to get cancer around here, it's going to be me, Dolly Trash Bags.
Everything isn't about you, you know.
Anybody around here is going to get cancer. We're all going to get cancer.
How long have I been at Kerr McGee?
2 years in October. Thelma only got 24 DPMs.
Is that bad?
It's not super bad. You just waking up to this? What do you think we're working with over there, Puff Tweet?
I'm just asking a question.
If you're really worried about it, stop smoking.
I don't think there is a scene in this movie where she is not chain smoking.
Yes, that did crack me up. I have a real life story about that later.
But I think the good thing about this movie is it doesn't sugarcoat anything or anyone's behavior. It points out very clearly there were flaws aplenty. And so it doesn't gloss over the fact that they're all very flawed, but that doesn't diminish the fact of what's happening. It doesn't diminish the fact of what she discovers or she thinks she discovers and what the company may have done.
Well, so she and her coworkers work at this fabrication site. She and her boyfriend and their roommate, played by Cher, work in different jobs at this factory. And Karen is portrayed as somebody who is very personable, and she seems to be very competent at her job. Well, she's competent at the job at hand. Again, she's not a scientist or all that well-versed, actually, on the effects of the things, things they're working with. Although, again, this is a period of time when it seems like between their union, which is fairly weak, and the government regulations, they're basically given information in ways that makes it difficult. I think it's kind of portrayed as it's sort of difficult for them to understand. Like, maybe they have to be told certain things by law, but it's presented in a form that unless you're actually going to go into it, like end user license agreements, kind of. That's kind of what I thought about the whole thing. It's like, maybe those things are available for you to read, but who reads them? Because you're just there to work your shift.
Yeah, I think it's a good analogy. I mean, they have obviously been told not to chew gum or eat food in work areas, but they still do. So, and they're not, I don't think, they're not like anti-authoritarian. So they're not trying to flout the rules just to flout the rules. It's obvious they don't understand why the rules are in place.
And like, they have to, before they leave the area with the material that they're working with, they have to do these scan things to make sure that they don't have any material on them, I guess. And it's clear that not everybody scans every time. It's kind of a hassle.
Yeah, it's not a passive system. You have to actively do it on your way out the door. I don't know, Eric, if you went to the reactor at Rolla. Jason, you did, right?
I did.
I went to it, but not while it was on.
Okay, so I don't know if you guys remember, but there was a portal scanner that you had to walk through on your way out.
I remember.
Yeah, so it scans everybody on the way out because you have to walk through it. At this plant where Silkwood is working, it was this like really small scanner that was kind of up high that you kind of had to wave your hands at to scan yourself on the way out the door.
Well, from certain rooms, but mm-hmm. They had a sensor at the entry point as well.
Yeah.
But I think it had probably a higher threshold.
Yeah. So they had a portal at the going into the plant, but not in the
ostensibly coming in or exiting.
Yeah, but not in the hot areas.
Which you would think would be nearly the opposite of what you would want.
Because now I can't remember the name of or the author of the book that we all listened to or talked about at the same time, probably a year and a half ago on the podcast. But this is roughly, well, I guess, in the continuum of the time period where nuclear accidents were caused by people with screwdrivers. So, I couldn't understand what they were doing in those like sifting things. Like, were they trying to like sift the material, like separate the components of this of like uranium ore or something?
Yeah. So the pellets were manufactured, and then they were sifting them to drop out any of the impurities, like any of the other dust that would have been on the pellets, and then they and then they moved the pellets onto the next phase of the system to get put in the control, the fuel rods, not the control rods.
And were these like pellets like welded together, or what were the welds that they eventually talked about?
The welds that Coach was inspecting. Those are the welds for the rods themselves.
So the pellets go into the rods?
Yes.
Okay. So the rods, or the, because I get the idea, maybe from James Bond movies, that these metal rods are like made of the pellets, but really it's pellets inside metal rods.
Yeah, that's what was the process at this Kerr-McGee plant, is the fissile material. I think they said it was plutonium. They were enriching it and producing little pellets, and then the pellets would have to get put into the rods in a very specific manner. Then the rods would have to be encased, encapsulated, so they'd weld them, I assume.
And Kurt Russell's character was involved in that process, I think, right? He was like a welder of some kind, it appeared.
Yeah, I don't know. I never really figured out what he did.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because there's, and you'll correct me, but there's a lot of like, they alluded to a lot of stuff, but I think they did a good job of kind of avoiding the nitty gritty.
Yeah, a lot of it was MacGuffinized.
A little bit. And partly, and I guess this is what I was dancing around a little bit, but this movie, the production of this movie, because this was the time, this movie was in 83, and Karen Silkwood died in 1974, and there was still a gigantic lawsuit at the time between her family and Kerr-McGee, and so the filmmakers, actually, they had to fight a big court battle about this movie. Where they had to, this movie was I think by the U.S. Supreme Court, this is an example of how a fictional movie could also be protected under the First Amendment, if it's talking about, if it's based on a true story. Like, they had to be very careful about what this movie alleges, which is why people thought that the ending of this movie was a bit of a cop-out. But anyway, we'll get to the end in a second. So we get to meet, in a very slow and deliberate pace. Again, this is a long movie, but I enjoyed every bit of it. We get to see like Karen's life around the, and her yucking it up with her coworkers, which, shall I just give the list of her coworkers and some of the other characters in this movie?
I think you should.
So director is Mike Nichols, who directed episode 115, Primary Colors. Sorry, directed the movie Primary Colors, our episode 115. Also, The Birdcage, Catch-22, and The Graduate. It was co-written by Nora Ephron from You've Got Mail, Sleepless in Seattle, and When Harry Met Sally fame, although I think this was her first big screenplay. Meryl Streep plays Karen Silkwood. She's from The Manchurian Candidate, 2004, episode 69. Her boyfriend is Drew Stevens, is played by Kurt Russell from Tombstone, episode 11, and The Thing, episode 48. And her friend, Dolly Pelliker, is played by Cher. And I can't believe we have gotten to this point, and this is our first Cher movie. Because Cher has been in movies like Moonstruck and Mermaids. And I forget, Cher is actually a pretty good actress.
She was really good in this. Yeah. And this was only her, what, second big role?
Yeah. And then, of course, their boss is Hurley, is played by Bruce McGill from Collateral, episode 9. The Sum of All Fears, episode 101, and The Last Boy Scout, episode 126. Also in the movie is Craig T. Nelson, TV's Coach, Poltergeist, and he has an, I think, uncredited appearance in Wag the Dog, episode 39. There's also coworker Charles Hallahan from The Thing, episode 48. There's Fred Ward, who, by the way, why is this the first Fred Ward movie we've seen? He is awesome. He was in Henry and June, Remo Williams, and The Right Stuff, among other things. We get to see, not in a creepy way, favorite, all-around nice guy, and the winner of the Best Hair in This Movie award, which is pretty incredible considering Kurt Russell's in this movie, David Strathairn. From Sneakers, episode 20, and Home for the Holidays, episode 123. We also have M. Emmett Walsh from Twilight, episode 193. And the upcoming Escape from the Planet of the Apes. And we have Tess Harper from No Country for Old Men, episode 154. Also in the cast, James Rebhorn from The Talented Mr. Ripley, episode 30. Anthony Held from Silence of the Lambs, episode 91, and Red Dragon, episode 90. Will Patton from Copycat, episode 108. Billy Cobbs from That Thing You Do, episode 119, The Color of Money, episode 42, and Trading Places, episode 128. J.C. Quinn from Primary Colors, episode 115. And then we have Kent Broadhurst from The Professional, which is a movie I thought we had covered, but we have not yet. Ron Silver, who, again, why is this the first Ron Silver movie we've seen? Because he was in Reversal of Fortune, Ali, and Time Cop.
Time Cop, yeah. Yes.
Oh, he played Alan Dershowitz.
He did. Reversal of Fortune's got to go on the calendar.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Yeah. And then, also...
If nothing else, I can do all those Sonny jokes. So.
And then, last but not least, Diana Scarwid from Psycho 3, which is a movie we didn't cover, but we talked a little about in our Psycho episode, so I didn't include that. But that's 21 episodes of Not in a Creepy Way.
And you didn't even mention Good Night and Good Luck.
Exactly, a movie which we should have, we talked about, but we haven't released the episode yet, so we'll see how that goes. Yeah, so 22 episodes then. So the backstory on the plot is, of course, we have Karen Silkwood, the main character, Meryl Streep, who she works at this factory. Again, boyfriend, roommate, coworker, whatever. She turns out she is a mother of, what, two or three children?
Three.
The father lives in the next state over.
He lives in Texas.
So she drives to see the kids, but she is estranged from her or divorced from her common-law husband. And she's not, obviously she's not the greatest mom.
Well, in the 70s, how bad a mom would she have to have been for her not to have the kids?
Yeah, they don't really go into that, but yeah, there's something going on there. And again, this is a movie about a real person, so they went out of their way to make the details as correct as possible. But they didn't really touch on why this whole thing happened. And I've heard from other podcasts people make fun of this, and so I could not help thinking of myself. We get to hear Meryl Streep sing.
Well, and I thought the most awkward part about that is she was singing in the car next to Cher.
With Cher,
exactly, yeah.
Like, isn't that the ultimate uncomfortable thing?
Yes, that's the thing, is it? So she's singing in the car, and she has a pretty good voice. You know, the thing that people make fun of is that, you know, did you know that Meryl Streep could sing? It's like, yeah, it turns out she sings quite a bit in her movies, so here and there. But yeah, she's sitting next to Cher, who is a professional singer, which is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, how intimidating must that have been for Meryl Streep?
Well, and it's funny because reading interviews at the time, Cher, because it was her like second role or whatever, but her first big movie, Cher was super intimidated. But Meryl Streep was like, greeted her like a long lost friend. It was like, oh, welcome. We're going to be buddies. And so they hung out like the whole time. So she thinks Meryl Streep is the bee's knees for like basically taking her under her wing and making it a super comfortable experience. And especially this is Cher, who is his, part of her appeal is her singing, but also a part of her appeal is her exotic good looks. And she gets the full on Charlize Theron monster treatment in this movie. Like, at a certain point, I got a little confused, and I thought, where is her funky-headed child? But no, that's a whole different Cher movie.
that was the first thing I ever saw Sam Elliott in.
The funky-headed Cher movie?
Yes.
Smokin'. Wait, that's funny. The other Mask movie.
Yeah, that's the other Mask.
Okay, so, anyway. Ba-dum-bum. You know, Brother Drew hates shtick. That's I can sense this from 10 miles away. Okay, so
I never said I hate shtick.
I think you were pretty clear on it.
That may be.
So we get, and of course, Kurt Russell, who is, you know, he's like handsome young Kurt Russell. Although it's funny because in Kurt Russell's career, this is not young Kurt Russell. Young Kurt Russell was in like Walt Disney movies as a teenager in like the late 50s, I think, early 60s. So this is sort of like middle-aged Kurt Russell, young to middle age, and he's a banjo playing Kurt Russell, which is, again, it's a fun little touch. So Karen is everybody's favorite rapscallion. She's sassy. She has a you know, her bosses don't appreciate her being sort of a troublemaker slash ringleader slash flaunting the rules. You know, again, she's not Norma Jean, Norma Ray. She's not any of the Norma. She's not Gidget. She's not the Flying Nun.
Yeah, she's certainly not virtuous either. She seems to get around, or at least has no problem with intimating that she gets around.
Well, again, Kurt Russell has that hilarious thing about, well, if you're so, we're all going to get cancer, and if you're so worried about it, maybe you should stop smoking. And then what's the share line at the end of the movie?
Shit. You can't do the shopping unless you give us your key.
What happened to your key?
If we knew that, we wouldn't need yours, would we?
I lost it.
Oh, you lost it.
Leave it under the step, okay? Well, if somebody comes in here and rapes me because you lost your key.
Who's going to rape you that you ain't already fucked?
Karen is that sassy coworker we all like, but there's got tension because she's a little bit casual with the rules, and on the other hand, she's too smart or nosy for her own good. But this isn't like a Scooby-Doo movie. I mean, this is just a movie about a real person with real issues. But we first see one of her coworker, an older lady coworker,
Thelma.
Yes, who gets cooked. She's exposed to radiation, and they have to scrub her down in a uncomfortable to watch scene. And she ends up, she wants to go visit her kids, and so she wants to get somebody to cover her shift, and nobody really wants to. And she makes an offhanded comment about if there was some sort of radiation leak or whatever, that they'd have to close the plant for the weekend, and she'd go see her kids anyway. So when there was a thing that happened, so suddenly there's scuttlebutt that she caused it. Just kind of a problem. So she ends up talking to the union folks. And I'm yada-yadding a little bit, because again, this is a slow-paced movie where you're kind of getting the interactions between everybody. And this is, of course, where you see her, they kind of breaking the rules by eating the birthday cake. Sorry, Brother Drew.
Yeah, the more disturbing one to me is when she was chewing gum and then popped a bubble and had good night and good luck come over and peel the gum off her face and then eat it himself.
No bueno from the radiation department.
I made the Brad Pitt from Fight Club like yick hand gesture when I saw that.
Then she ends up getting contaminated. Brother Jay.
Yeah.
That's your.
She gets cooked.
Your scoliosis is coming along.
No, I'm listening.
I'm like, I'm going to veer a little bit because my notes aren't play by play. So sorry, I got that sense of judgment coming along.
Nope. You're good.
All right. So anyway, so she ends up getting a little bit more involved in the union stuff and the rules about what the factory needs to do. And there's this thing about this truck that got some contamination that they're supposed to cut up and put into pieces, but maybe they didn't do that properly. I wasn't quite clear on what happened to the truck.
I think the implication was instead of properly disposing of a radioactive truck, which would be very costly and difficult, they cut it into pieces and buried it.
So again, so she's maybe blamed for this being like the source of some sort of contamination. And so she's trying to get her reputation back as well as she's learning all these things. And then she gets forcibly transferred. By the way, what was the deal with her going to the break room and eating everybody's food? Like, what was that supposed to represent?
That was just to show what a free spirit she was, I think.
Well, also the fact that perhaps she had been on more than just passing terms with most of the male population.
Okay, maybe that was it. But she ends up getting transferred to from her job that she likes to and she has seniority to a section where she has no seniority. And suddenly she's working under or near Craig T. Nelson, TV's coach.
So she's no longer in an environment where she can cause too much trouble.
Exactly.
By annoying, pestering, or influencing coworkers.
And what's the division she gets transferred to? What it's called?
Radiography.
Okay. It's explained to her in a little bit of creepy exposition that, you know, her job is to follow these pellets on their process. And then eventually Craig T. Nelson will be, or she takes photographs of these things, and Craig T. Nelson will look at the photographs to see if the welds are correct. And she asks him at one point what he's doing, and he's taking a Sharpie
and fixing the negatives. And
yeah, so he's just blotting out these little white spots, which are evidently like maybe incomplete welds or defects in the welding,
mm-hmm.
which could cause a leak of radiation or instability or something. Turns out that could be no bueno in the breeder reactor.
Yeah. Yep.
So, and it's unclear, at least to me, it was unclear that she knew the gravity of what she was finding out, but she knew she had to tell somebody about it. So she told the union, again, the local union people, who the union itself didn't seem to be terribly strong. In fact, they had, the company had forced a vote to decertify. Yeah, the union.
Decertify.
Yes. So there was some interest in the national union and the Atomic Energy Commission. Are they the one that was Ron Glass's concern?
Well, the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is one entity. So
that was the thing about this movie, though. There was all this sketchy stuff going on at the manufacturing plant, but the union was not. They didn't really have any intention of righting the wrongs and fixing everything for the workers. They were really just focused on getting dirt so they would have leverage in a labor negotiation.
Yeah, or for lobbying generally. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they just wanted to keep themselves in play. They didn't want the union going away. They wanted the union to stay.
Yeah, and they were happy to use her.
Yeah, that was I think, a really serious disconnect in what Silkwood was experiencing, because she felt wrong. She felt like she was the victim of reprisal for something that she hadn't even done in the first place. So she sort of was trying to go on a crusade, and she had the backing of the National Union, but their goals were not aligned.
No, not at all. And things are getting progressively worse for her at work, because she, you know, after we see her help her friend who had a forced scrub down, and then she has her first forced scrub down, then she actually comes up with another situation where she is, she turns up to setting off the alarms. And so she gets scrubbed down again. And so, Drew, you thought at this point maybe that they weren't doing this on purpose to her. It wasn't necessarily nefarious as much as it was just...
This time around, I didn't necessarily think it was that she was set up. I mean, I think the first time I watched it, I was certain that it was a setup and that she was being punished. But the second time around, I got the sense it was just as likely that the workplace practices were so poor that she could have easily gotten contaminated again. I don't think her gloves or anything had to have been spiked. And she wasn't really taking her job very seriously at this point. She was really just working for the union.
Yeah, trying to collect information.
Yeah. So her head wasn't really in the game as far as safety was concerned. Her own, anyway.
Yeah. And then, of course, as she learns more about maybe the practices that are not safe in her factory, and now she's been exposed to radiation on her own, she's now required to do these take-home urine test things that just to collect her urine and bring it back. And she's far from the only one who's got to do this.
Yeah, just about every single employee.
Yeah, and she's learning that... that maybe the levels of radiation they've been exposed to are vastly more dangerous than they were led to believe, even by her union folks.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause again, their ultimate goal is not necessarily workplace safety.
Not at all.
So it's getting progressively more tense for Karen. And then we have some fun things happen because, of course, fun's not the right word, but, you know, her personal life is also going downhill because, you know, so she and her boyfriend, are a fun couple, and their roommate now is it. So they did not realize at this point that Cher was a lesbian.
I got the feeling, Karen knew. Or if she didn't think Dolly was, a full blown lesbian, she knew that Dolly was attracted to her.
Yeah,
but I think she and Kurt Russell were surprised that Dolly was willing to be so open about it by bringing home a lady friend.
Which was, I love that uncomfortable conversation they had with each other. After, mm-hmm. The night after, that's where we meet Angela, the beautician, well, the funeral home beautician, she's the comic relief in, you know, it's again, it's a little bit of a tragic comedy.
Well, she makes the observation that, you know, she's the one who takes care of all the dead Kerr McGee employees, and they look dead before yes. they're even dead.
Yeah. So now, you know, Karen's life is unraveling. She's got to do these tests. She's now, her job has turned from something that she's used to something she's not. And now she's not only does she not like the new division that she's working in, but yeah, she's spending most of her time spying anyway. And, this is driving her boyfriend crazy. Cause he's like, why don't we just leave? So. He's going to just move out. He's done. He's like, okay, I can't, you know.
Well, he quits his job.
Well, exactly, yeah.
That precipitates, you know, the discussion. And then he's like, then he's out of there. But they have that great moment where, you know, he tells her, you know, like, he stops the car and comes back to her and says he loves her and leaves anyway, which is heart-wrenching.
There's a lot of emotion in this movie. Again, it's sort of melodrama.
I wish I could quit you.
Well, yeah, but I think it's all earned. I mean, this is, you know, if this was like one notch schmaltier, it would be like, but this is not a Hallmark movie.
And Kurt Russell is so good. It made me realize, even in bad movies, I think Kurt Russell is always really good.
Oh, yeah. He's one of those movie star guys.
Yeah, I don't really think of him as like a leading man movie star, but he is. He nails it every time.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, action movies, dramas,
comedies.
Absolutely.
Tombstone, which is all three.
Exactly. And then we have Karen getting in touch with the labor people who are going to get in touch with the national labor people who are going to get in touch with the reporter from the New York Times. And she and Ron Silver get into the thing. Now, is this is after she breaks up with Drew, or just before he breaks up with Drew?
Well, she has a thing with him to begin yeah. with when she goes to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so.
The first time, while they're still a couple. Although, again, you get the impression, had she told him that she had done it, he wouldn't have cared, but it's that she didn't tell him.
I think he would have cared.
So here's where, and again, there's a little bit of yada yada here, but this is where the some of the reviewers thought this movie copped out, because what happened in real life is after a union meeting, but before her meeting with the reporter from the New York Times, Karen was involved in a fatal traffic accident,
a single car accident,
and so. The speculation was that she was murdered because she knew too much. And, you know, she actually, the family won. They won the first round of a wrongful death suit, and ended up getting a settlement from Kerr McGee. So that, you know, that lends some sort of credence that they had some sort of culpability. Otherwise, like, they wouldn't have settled with the family, you'd think. Cause I think it was like, over $1 million. So it was originally
$1.53 million, I believe.
Yeah. So that's not just going away money. So a lot of the reviewers at the time, not Roger Ebert, who really liked it, but some of the other reviewers were like, oh no, this is a cop out ending. Like, don't build this all into what's, you know, going to be a thriller, you know, All the President's Men, and then don't give us the ending that we want. You know, we want to see Craig T. Nelson be the one to drive her off the road and rub his hands together and rape her dead body. But, well, no, we don't want that. But
yeah, but it wasn't that kind of movie, like you mentioned before. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a procedural or it wasn't a thriller. This is just a character study.
Yeah, and a bunch of tragic characters. But a bunch of real, I mean, they all felt real. These felt like real people, which is the magic of this kind of movie.
They also made a point at the end of the movie, you never see a car run her off the road. You never, I mean, you see the hint of the of tail of headlights in her rearview mirror, but they never show anything that indicates that she was that other than a single car accident. So I think the movie does a good point about leaving things vague. So I appreciate that because nobody knows.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you see her leaving the meeting with some paperwork, but it's not like she's leaving the meeting saying, I'm taking all the, you know, I'm taking the smoking gun paperwork to the New York Times writer, everybody. Bye-bye now. It's like a much more subtle scene than that. And sadly, the whole a cappella Meryl Streep singing at the end really was kind of touching. It was a really nice way to, you know, with the headlights in the background and, yeah.
Yeah, most of the characters in this movie just seemed like real, fully fleshed out people. You know, even I think one of my favorite parts is when Kurt Russell's character Drew shows up at the place he used to live after Kerr McGee scrubbed it because of the contamination, and he runs into Craig T. Nelson.
Winston.
Winston, and they have a tense conversation, and then Kurt Russell sucker punches him. But you know, in a lesser movie, it would have been like this like heroic, defiant act. But he sucker punches him, and then he gets scared and runs away.
Oh yeah, because Craig T. Nelson can kick your ass. I mean, you know, Kurt Russell, you know, had abs on him and stuff, but I think Craig T. Nelson is like a foot taller than Kurt Russell.
He's a big dude.
He's like a football coach.
Well, he certainly looked imposing, and they made him look very sinister and imposing.
But I mean, just like, again, I love David Strathairn and his cheeky tomboyish attitude. Tomboy, that's not a right word. Boyish attitude and lovely hair. But how about Fred Ward's Native American jokes?
Hey, Karen, I got one for you. For as long as anyone could remember, this Indian chief was in charge of naming all the children that were born in the tribe. And one day, this one brave comes up to him and says, Chief, can I ask you something? How do you name these children? How do you think of their names? The chief says, it was very simple. When a child is born and I see snow gently falling, I say, you shall be called Snow Gently Falling. And when a child is born and I see a hawk flying over, I say, you shall be named Hawk Flying Over. But tell me, two dogs fucking, why are you so interested?
I assume he was supposed to be a Native American, his character.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Hence the two dogs fucking.
Well, yeah. And it's actually, I don't even know what national or what do you call it?
Ethnicity.
Ethnicity. Yeah. Fred Ward really is.
He's Californian.
Yeah, I think so. Probably. Tremors. You gotta watch Tremors. Or Henry and June for different reasons.
I'm up for Remo Williams.
Yeah. Oh, man, that could have made him a star.
It did, didn't it?
Oh, maybe. But wasn't it supposed to be like a series, or was it a goof?
I have no idea.
Only history will tell.
Fred Joe Ward, born in San Diego, California, is part Cherokee in descent. Before acting, Ward spent 3 years in the United States Air Force. He also was a boxer and worked as a lumberjack in Alaska.
All of that is completely reads true. He looks like the guy that would have done all that. I could see him running into Danny Trejo at a job center.
Machete.
But not in a bad way, by the way. But yeah, I really dug this movie. I mean, for a... and it's not really a period piece, but it's kind of a, you know, a period piece. Slice of life from the early 70s. Melodrama. It was great. I mean, this is, to me, giving my verdict first for a change, this is a badass movie. So, Brother Jay?
Yeah, this is one of the surprising revisits that I've had. And I give this movie an A. It's a great movie. It's well acted. It's well crafted. The dialogue is crisp. And real, I mean, it seems realistic, for as much as it is a dramatization of true life events. It seems plausible and scarily accurate from the perspective of a screenplay. Obviously, there's some liberty taken here and there, but, from a story standpoint, the movie has some slow parts, but to me, it never dragged that much. I know that towards the end, especially the last couple 5 minutes, boyfriend Jesse was like, "Just end already."
he didn't dig the final song.
I think he wasn't sure it was going to end at the song, and so I think he was concerned that it was just going to drag. Because you really don't know. I mean, if you haven't ever seen the movie before, you know you've already been in this ride for 2+ hours, and you're like, "Oh God, what's next?" Because this movie was a slow burn. It didn't move very fast in the beginning. There was a lot of kind of deliberate build, which I think built tension.
Yeah, and if you expected like to get some concrete resolution, then you weren't expecting the movie to end where it did.
It certainly had an abrupt cut at the end, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that did the movie a great service, not a disservice. I think it was a good ending. I think had they done something cheesier or something more elaborate, or even tried to, I mean, if they had, I think showing the gravestone was one thing, but had they shown like a funeral procession or people gathered, that would have just been too much over the top.
Yeah, well, it was also unclear how many people would really show up for her funeral.
That's probably also true. But seemingly, Drew would have showed up because he was back in the, you know, back on her side.
Yep, they were back together. Brother Drew, was it worth it? Oh, thank you for asking. No, it was totally worth it. No, like both of you have said, this is a really good movie. And Eric, you already touched on, you know, some of what my takeaway thoughts are. It's a really great movie about people. And it's the story is sort of interesting background. But the characters are what really take you through the movie. And the journey that they go on is really interesting. And it feels really honest. And in a more dramatic movie, they would have really hammed up some emotional scenes, as like you mentioned, Eric, as Oscar bait. But I think this is, for all of the melodrama, I think this is actually a really understated movie. It uses that to great effect. You know, it doesn't go over the top very often, but it's really effective. As long as it was, this movie was nice and tight and effective. So I would recommend anybody who hasn't seen it spend the time to watch it, because it's a bunch of actors really at their best. And it was really a pleasure to watch.
So tell us about the parts of the movie that made you ultra uncomfortable.
Just the workplace safety.
Just all that.
Yeah, all that stuff made me uncomfortable.
Because you're a safety guy.
Well, I don't know. I've been in similar situations and I know how it works. And I didn't go into the nuclear industry as a profession after I got my degree, but I did go into environmental cleanup. So there are similar aspects to dealing with contamination. And if you're not careful, it can get everywhere. And if it's something really nasty, like radiation that you can't see, you can't smell, if you get it on you and you carry it home, it can be really disastrous. And yeah, so when they went to her house and started screening it and it started clicking, I was just, just made the hair on my neck stand up. Because, you know, I've worked at cleanup sites where we've been cleaning up PCBs. And I always had a really similar feel to that because unless it's a really strong concentration, you can't smell them. You can't see them. They're not soluble. So it just, you know, they're hard to get rid of. So if you're not careful, you can carry them around with you. You can bring them home on your shoes if you don't decon them. And PCBs are nasty. They can be a teratogen. So all that stuff just made me super uncomfortable thinking about it.
At the point you're that contaminated, would that amount of scrubbing really matter that much? It would make you less contaminated for others, but it's not going to do much for you personally, right, at that point?
Well, yeah, I think they were suggesting that she had internal contamination. So you're not going to scrub that away.
Yeah, and contamination is a weird thing. I mean, there's all sorts of different types of radiation damage that you could take.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think about it generally as it being like, you know, so like the gamma rays that made the Hulk. But yeah, that's only one.
Indeed it is.
Yes. And what is it? Like you can avoid alpha particles or something by just wearing a heavy coat? Unless you breathe them. Could be a problem.
Yep.
So
ingesting them, that's a problem.
Yeah. So can we talk about a lighter topic and the 56th Annual Academy Awards, 1984?
Sure.
The best picture? Silkwood was not up for best picture. But the winner of Best Picture was Terms of Endearment over The Big Chill, The Dresser, The Right Stuff, and Tender Mercies.
Wow, what a year for movies.
Oh, man. So Mike Nichols...
What the heck is The Dresser?
Wasn't that... That was a period piece.
I've never heard of that one.
I'll get there in a second. We'll educate everyone. So Best Director was won by James L. Brooks from Terms of Endearment. But Peter Yates from The Dresser, Ingmar Bergman for Fanny Alexander, Mike Nichols from Silkwood, and Bruce Beresford for Tender Mercies was up for the award. The Best Actor, Albert Finney for The Dresser, Thomas Courtenay from The Dresser, Tom Conti from Rubin, Michael Caine from Educating Rita, but the winner was Robert Duvall from Tender Mercies. Best Actress, Meryl Streep was up for Karen Silkwood, Julia Walters for Educating Rita, Deborah Winger for Terms of Endearment, Jane Alexander from Testament, but the winner was Shirley MacLaine, Terms of Endearment. Best Supporting Actor, Rip Torn from Cross Creek, Sam Shepard from The Right Stuff, John Lithgow from Terms of Endearment, Charles Durning from To Be or Not to Be, but the winner was Jack Nicholson for Terms of Endearment. I've never seen Terms of Endearment. I
haven't either.
This may have been on the same tape as Silkwood in Terms of Endearment, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Best Supporting Actress. This actually, Best Supporting Actress gets a little more interesting. So, Alfre Woodard from Cross Creek, Amy Irving from Yentl, Glenn Close from The Big Chill, Cher from Silkwood. The winner was Linda Hunt, The Year of Living Dangerously.
Oh.
She was playing a man, baby.
That's a good movie.
Yeah. Best Screenplay. War Games, Silkwood, Fanny Alexander, The Big Chill, but winner was Tender Mercies.
War Games?
Yes.
War Games is an Oscar-nominated movie.
For Best Original Screenplay. Would you like to play a game? Best Original Score? Yentl? I'm sorry, Best Original Score, The Right Stuff. Best Adaptation? Yentl. Best Original Song? Flashdance, What a Feeling. The one over Maniac from Flashdance, Over You from Tender Mercies, Papa Can You Hear Me from Yentl, and The Way He Makes Me Feel from Yentl. Special Achievement Academy Award was for Return of the Jedi, Achievement in Ewok Technology. So, The Dresser, not going on the calendar. It's a 1983 film, with a screenplay by Ronald Howard, based on his 1980 play, The Dresser. It tells a story of an aging actor's personal assistant, who struggles to keep his charge's life together. It stars Albert Finney, Tom Courtenay, Zena Walker, Eileen Atkins, Michael Goh, and Edward Fox.
It was also remade.
They remade The Dresser?
Mm-hmm. Sir Ian McKellen.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
I think it was... Let's see. I want to say it was on TV, but I could be wrong. Emily Watson, Ian McKellen.
Ian McKellen plays the Albert Finney role, I assume?
No. What? No, he plays Norman. Anthony Hopkins plays Sir.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. 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 What year was that?
2015.
Hmm.
It has 6.8 stars on IMDb.
So while we're still kind of in this liquid arena, Drew, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
Topic of conversation was surgeries that went bad. This is not my question. My coworker was talking about how his members of his organization were on a surprising number of drugs. One of which was Wellbutrin, sometimes Chantix. And then that turned into, well, you know, if turns out if you're a professional commercial pilot and you're taking Chantix to quit smoking, you could actually put your pilot's license in jeopardy because you're not taking a psychiatric drug. And then that led to my bit of trivia. I remembered that the reactor at Rolla was the only indoor place in Missouri you could smoke or something like that, or on campus maybe, because you couldn't leave when the reactor was on if you're operating the reactor or something. Did I get the story right? No.
I don't remember that aspect of it. But yeah, operators could not go take smoke breaks outside the building. That's for sure.
Yeah. So the question came up, musing was, okay, so are there fitness tests like drug tests and stuff for operators of nuclear reactors, do you think?
Oh, certainly.
Would like psychiatric drugs prevent you from being a reactor operator, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I doubt it. If you're under a doctor's supervision and you're fit for work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems like, you know, on one hand, it seems, yeah, that's pretty clear. On the other hand, you know, you could actually lose even your private pilot's license if you're a lady with thyroid trouble and are taking thyroid medication, because the FAA determines that that's something that could make you unable to fly. Okay, so housekeeping.
Housekeeping. So, Dad's reaction to watching The Assignment.
You have that reaction? Or are you asking for the reaction?
No, I think Drew had it.
Yeah, he was really amused that we watched it. And not only watched it, but talked about it. Yeah.
No, he had not seen it at the time that he mentioned that he was going to see it, right? That we should talk about it, or it intrigued him?
I think he had.
I thought he was spooling it up for the trip at the point where... Because remember, he was asking you about the movies he was going to take on the trip?
Yeah, but then he, after the trip, didn't he tell you that we should... He told one of you that we should do it on the podcast.
No, on the way to the airport, he asked me if I had heard of the movie or seen the movie. I'm like, no, but I've heard you're going to recommend it. And he goes, yeah, I don't know yet. Whatever. So, yeah, no, he definitely seemed amused when I said, you know, that was not the greatest movie.
Thanks for the suggestion. We want more movies like Blue Ruin and less like The Assignment.
Yes.
But, so my final housekeeping story. It is clear in the years since I have left Fred Meyer that the staffing standards and or rules and procedures of hiring and maintaining employees has had a profound change in policy and execution, which has culminated in a very different culture, at least at the Fred Meyer around my house. Most noticeably now, many people have visible body piercings and tattoos, which would never have been allowed when I was hiring people, let alone working there. You couldn't have any visible body jewelry other than standard earrings and wedding rings. No lip rings, no tongue studs, no nose rings.
Gauged out ears.
None of that, which clearly is allowed now, probably because they couldn't get employees. But along with that, there seems to be a certain level of candor with the cashiers that didn't exist before either. So, boyfriend Jesse and I were shopping at Fred Meyer a couple weeks ago, and it was one of the really late, hot nights here that had been like 100 degrees, and I wasn't really cooking much, so we went to the grocery store, I think, to pick up a couple things, and we ended up buying just because it was late at night, and we were both tired and hungry and hot. We wanted to kind of linger in the grocery store where it was cool and wander up and down the frozen foods aisle and the refrigerated aisle. We kind of ended up purchasing this strange melange of items, I think, which was like baby shampoo and whipped cream and chocolate eclairs and cookies. And I mean, it was just this strange mix of things. And as we were checking out, the cashier said, I know, it looks like a really strange combination of stuff. It was just kind of a strange night. She goes, well, that's not the strangest thing. The strangest thing was when I had a customer yesterday who came out and the only thing that they were buying was a baby toilet seat and a cock ring.
I didn't know.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I screwed up the delivery. A baby toilet seat and a vibrating cock ring.
Ah, okay.
to which Jesse burst into laughter, and I actually couldn't speak. I could not make words come out of my mouth. I could not force words because I wasn't sure I had heard her correctly. I was convinced, actually, that I had misheard her. There was no way that a cashier just said cock ring in the line, the cashier line at Fred Meyer. There was no way. Fred Meyer himself was probably spinning in his grave, or vibrating as it may be. But good God, I just couldn't fathom it. My brain could not physically register it. And in the car, we kind of discussed, because I was not the first thing that Meyer actually was like, Fred Meyer sells cock rings now? Like, what? And then it dawned on me, it was probably one of those little Trojan vibrating toy things that they sell with the weird personal lubricants. I'm using personal lubricants in air quotes. So, but
wait, I would think you'd use weird in air quotes.
But so anyway, that was my experience. I don't know if either of you have had similar expanded horizon employees at Fred Meyer, but so it's a thing, at least in Portland. So that was my Fred Meyer story I wanted to share. I'm sure their public relations people would be thrilled to hear this.
That sounds like a fun evening.
Well, I don't know. Baby toilet seat and vibrating cock ring. I don't know. Somebody had a party, but it's probably not legal.
Does it make you feel like a grumpy old man a little bit?
I didn't begrudge the cashier. I wasn't offended. I was just more surprised.
Yeah. I don't care. That wasn't a criticism of you. It's just a,
I feel grumpy old man over other things, but not this. I feel grumpy old man when I'm walking behind people and they're unaware entirely of their existence of other people around them to the point where I have to take action loudly. Which is usually me yelling, excuse you. So, not excuse me. I don't need excusing. You need excusing. You need to get the fuck out of my way. So.
I have kind of a grumpy old man story. But, Drew, do you have anything to add to the vibrating cock ring story?
Well, again, thank you for asking. No.
Well, we do have pump up the volume on the calendar here soon, so, you know, again.
Yeah, is it bigger than a baby's arm?
Exactly, yes. You know, always looking for an eat me, beat me girl.
I'm to remind you, Kaladi Brothers.
Yes, so I had not heard this term before, but are you familiar with the rowdy beard?
I am not.
Nope.
Well, I think maybe it's a brand name, but so you know the there's a certain hipster what do you call it, like style now. Think a guy who's dressed in sort of maybe old-timey bartender's clothes with maybe like a bow tie and maybe even suspenders, but otherwise like a nice button-up dress shirt and maybe like a sport coat over it, or maybe just some sort of vest over it, but has like long, straight, sort of almost pompadour-y hair, but also a full beard in a full beard, but also like expertly manicured beard.
Yes, that's called douchebag.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah, I think fancy lumberjack.
Yes, exactly. So, okay, so I'm part of this parent. Turns out I'm the board of this parent teacher organization that we are talking about. We're flirting with the idea of merging with the actual PTA of the school. Blah blah blah. That's not probably going to happen, at least in the near future. But to negotiate a little bit about what that might look like, we had these sort of unofficial board meeting of both boards at the same time at the Kaladi Brothers coffee shop, and it is a hipster coffee shop. Although, you know, to me, I mean, Anchorage has been a coffee place for a while, so $5 coffee drinks is not a new thing, and it's not a Starbucks thing. We had swanky coffee, hipster coffee, snobby coffee, you know, before Starbucks. So we were meeting there as a place to meet, and you know, it's pretty casual or whatever. And there's some like areas that are set up for kind of like meetings. So you don't like rent space or anything, but you go there and there's big tables you can sit around, and so they encourage that kind of thing. So I'm getting there and I get there a little early, and a couple other board members are there, and we're ordering expensive coffees and sort of sitting around this big main bar, like a big long table with like bar stools next to it. That was in the middle of this sort of long area. But next to the window, they had these like little like two top tables, kind of like these little tables with two chairs around them next to the window. And the only other person, there were a couple meetings at other little offshoot rooms of this place, but pretty much the only other customer was this guy with his rowdy beard, right? And he's sitting there, and he's got his cup of what I can only assume is tea, and he is all dressed up, you know, and his, I think he had a vest on, but again, he was dressed up like kind of old timey bartender, and he had this beard and hair, and he was full on knitting. Like knit one, purl two, like knitting a scarf or something. And my instant reaction, being grumpy old man, is to look at him and say, fuck you. Like this whole thing here, what you're doing, fuck you. But so I was like, oh, well, that's not fair, you know. Although the whole thing sort of offended me on some sort of level. But what was hilarious,
yeah, I mean, for all you know, he could have been like doing stained glass.
Well, that's the thing. Is like I can imagine this guy who is sitting there knitting with his oolong tea or whatever, looks up at me with my basketball shorts and looks like, dude, you haven't played basketball in 20 years. If then, you fat bastard, get out of my hipster coffee shop. Fuck you. So I'm sure there's.
So it's all really a place for bridging worlds together.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a cup of diversity.
I'm not saying he wasn't a good kisser. I'm just saying that it was the whole, yeah, his whole aesthetic irritated me as a grumpy old.
No. Yeah, no. Douchebag. The knitting needles would have gone into his eyeballs.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, I don't wish him any ill will, except that, oh, you.
Oh, I'll wish him all kinds of ill will. Get out of here. That's just pretentious bullshit.
Yeah. It'd be like somebody with like full on 70s, like, foot and a half mohawk or something.
I bet had you looked close at the if you had looked close at the pattern of the scarf, it would have said PETA.
Oh, who knows? Yeah, I'm sure he goes
or green plans, or so. Greenpeace.
Yeah.
Now the curmudgeon Nader. The curmudgeon in me gets annoyed at any time anybody's doing any sort of recreational activity at a coffee shop, because you're just. At that point, they're just screaming for attention. They want somebody to come over and ask them about whatever quirky thing they're doing. It's like, yeah, you live somewhere. You live somewhere.
Go to that place.
Knit at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe his knitting group had already met and he just wanted to get to the end of a row or something. Again, I don't know. I don't have to fulfill this guy's backstory. But yeah, his whole aesthetic made me yell at a cloud. That was kind of, yeah. So that's my housekeeping, is that I'm not very tolerant, I guess. And send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.